It was intended for the human to support the machine to support the human at work.
And AI means something different to anybody you talk to, which is wild.
This is AI or Die.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to AI or Die, episode 18. Special episode today. Reagan and I are in the office together, so we're going to be doing it from the same screen. Brendan, as usual, is calling in from Europe. Hi, Brendan. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. It's great here in sunny Spain.
Yeah, sunny Spain. With that, today's episode, we're going to start with the news as always, but at AI or Die, we get a lot of listener questions coming in. So we're going to go through some of the top ones that we've gotten in the past. Folks are always asking us, you know, what we're seeing just in terms of large enterprises trying to scale AI. So we have some handpicked listener questions that we're going to go through and do more of a Q&A episode this time around. So we're looking forward to that. But to start, as always, how are we doing? Reagan, I'll start with you. What's going on in your life? What's new? What's going on?
Oh, you know, moving.
That's right.
I think I talked about this.
Moving into a new home.
We're in the final stages of moving all of our stuff, and you don't ever realize how much crap you have until you have to move it. Part of me loves it, like organizing everything and like getting rid of stuff. But yeah, this has just been painful because your life is in like an absolute chaos mode.
Yeah.
You know, like you can't find anything. Is it at the new house? Is it at the old place? So yeah, just pure chaos. I've been in the office every day this week because I cannot stand to work out of my house right now.
Just to hide from it.
Yeah. I'm just like blocking it out completely. So that's not fun, but you know, we'll be done by Monday.
So. Calling your bluff on that, if we record this next episode a month from now, episode 19, and you're still talking about moving, we'll see if you're still done at that point or not.
We have to be out by Monday. So we're going to be out.
Yeah. We have to. Brendan, you're familiar with it. I'm sure you've gone through and just gotten rid of stuff with all these moves that you've been doing.
I think we moved 4 times in a year or something. One of those being actually moving across to Europe. So I'm pretty good at it. The funniest thing to me is like, I think about this, like one of the most interesting statistics of my life will be the number of addresses that I've like been registered at and lived at, because it's probably like 25 as an adult or something stupid. And 5 of those are in the last year. So good times.
The truth's in a lie. You can use that one.
That's right.
Yeah, it's like funny to look at my Amazon list of like addresses that I've shipped to, and I have to like scroll, like it's a scroll list. It's not like a short list, you know, so.
You might have this already. Do you have one of those like global maps where you can put pins on like places you've lived? People do it for like places they've traveled to, but
I feel like one.
Places you've lived is a good one.
Yeah. I have both in different colors for different places I've lived versus traveled. Yeah,
it's a funny one because like I got rid of all my like wall art because I couldn't like travel with it. So I always think about that. I'm like, there's a subsection of people that like travel so much that they can't even like carry one of those around, you know? Like,
oh yeah. Yeah. I know. I was just like realizing we have so many instruments and so many
musical
like,
instruments.
Yes.
Yeah.
So many activities. Like as we were boxing things, I was marking it as like activities.
Like
how many items do we own where we're just doing activities?
You talk about like intelligence and human intelligence, just the amount of stuff that we've forgotten from like hobbies and talents. Of like at one time I was way better at piano than I am now, right? Yeah. Like it comes and goes with musical instruments, especially. That's funny.
It's wild. How about you, Nick?
Let's see. What is going on in my life? Oh, I went to a fantastic conference in San Francisco last week. It's called SASTR. Basically, it's really focused on hypergrowth startups with a real focus for me on the customer success space. So it was awesome. I love San Francisco as a city going out there. It was all week long. They had a whole event, basically Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Some badass speakers just from OpenAI, from Glean, from some of the really Calendly, some really important, you know, hyper growth companies over the past couple of years. So that was great to meet those folks. Being California, just the food is amazing out there too. So
what are your biggest insights from the AI customer success people?
Biggest insights, and this is something that we talk about a lot, but I think hearing it from them really reinforced it, which was make sure to keep the human at the center of all this conversation. We talk about the capabilities of AI. We talk about all the possibilities of what it can do in changing our lives. But let's not forget it's a tool that serves us as humans. And let's make sure to keep the humans at the center of the conversation and really focus our efforts on how can we make just a human's day better with a lot of these solutions that we're coming out with too. That's a big one that stuck out to me. Really, the other one was really interesting that a lot of people were talking about, which was just the amount of experimentation that large enterprises are doing with all of the different solutions coming to market. Mm-hmm. Unlike really prior, you know, focus areas for a lot of these startups, now enterprises are really testing out 5 or 6 different solutions for the same problem at the same time. So it's very interesting to hear just how much more experimentation is happening with this AI space and how it's even continuing. Like, we've been in it for years, but just still how much the enterprise is experimenting with solutions that fit into the problems they have. Like, one person spoke about a very large bank having 5 solutions to address the same security team and same security issue problem. And they're just really experimenting with that in the short term, which is super interesting.
I'm so excited to see how the build versus buy landscape and ecosystem continues to, you know, change and shift, because it was build everything for a while. And then now a lot of these solutions are getting pretty good. And so now people are shifting more into buy. And we always suggest and recommend that if there is a solid solution out there to buy, you should buy it. If you're not equipped to build things internally, right? It is a much faster way to get started. Now there's some obvious risk associated with that, so you have to be thoughtful about that. But, you know, these models that people are building that are specialized in certain areas, it makes sense for you to leverage that intelligence and incorporate it into your company. So I'm just so curious to see how that continues to evolve over time.
Yeah, it's also so interesting to think about for like traditional classification model use cases, like everybody builds those. And then everything generative AI, it feels like it's, you got to check to make sure you can't just buy it first, you know?
Right.
Like, that's such a really stark difference where people, because I remember people trying to sell this whole build, like buy a classification model for that use case.
Yeah.
And I feel like that never really panned out. I wonder if it's like just the accuracy and performance weren't there without like a lot of the specific data and nuances for a process. But it seems like generative people are like, those solutions work a lot better across organizations or across companies. So.
Yeah,
interesting.
We talk about like the business and technical teams, right? And historically, how much collaboration has been needed between the business and technical teams for getting those solutions to the business. Now there's so many solutions that go direct to business. What is that role that the technical team plays in helping support the business to pick the right solutions, look at other solutions that the technical team has already considered or is bringing in as well? There's just so much new solutions that are coming to the space that are just direct to business, and like trying to wrangle that with groups like AI governance committees and AI COEs in the enterprise.
I often get the questions of like, because there are so many new ones out there, people who are not super, super deep in the scene, like you got your enterprise leaders who are like, you're deep into this. Tell me which ones are real and which ones aren't.
Yeah.
Like, people are so afraid of like dealing with a very early company or one that's not real or that's vaporware, or, you know, there's just so much confusion in the market right now that like getting a stamp of approval by somebody, I think, is super important and interesting. And so we get that question a ton. A lot of our customers are like, what's the newest thing and what's real?
It's still that word of mouth. It's still colleagues in your industry recommending, hey, I did this. It is real. It provided real value. I recommend you try it in your space as well too. I think still, that's still going to be a huge engine for a lot of these solutions.
Yeah. And I don't want to backtrack too hard, but just to your point, Nick, around people are seeing it like putting the human in the center from the Sastr conference. I feel like it's interesting being as far into the generative AI wave as we are to kind of know now that most of the use cases that we're seeing are, that are successful are not fully automated. I was thinking about this the other day, like a lot of them are still human in the loop. So somebody reviewing the outputs of the model and leveraging it, like it still is very much augmenting rather than replacing a lot of work today. I mean, it replaces as it augments, of course, or like reduces the total workload, but it's not been a lot of like clear cut. Somebody used to make these decisions and now the AI makes those decisions. I think we'll get there, but we're just not there yet. I wonder if the agentic stuff will push that forward. But I was thinking about that the other day, like a lot of the use cases we still see are very much like augmenting people's workloads and like workflows that exist today.
And augmenting other solutions too. That's where we talked in prior episodes around AI. It's starting to live under OpEx for a lot of these enterprises because there's also automation. There's also classic continuous improvement. So with these AI solutions coming in, there's also aspects of automation as part of the process. And then the AI intelligence layer within there too. It's not quite end to end for these solutions quite yet. Maybe it'll get there. I'm curious to see. So that's me. What's going on in your life, B?
Zach, keep mine short because I don't have too much going on. It's great. I've just been hanging out in Spain. I've been traveling all summer, so it's been nice just to like kind of kick it for September, hanging out here. So just been working out, going to the beach, doing Spain stuff, you know, chilling. It's good.
I've been working out more too, trying to get in shape this winter for sure. Great. So that's us. Now let's flip to the news. I think there is some really hot off the presses news out of OpenAI in terms of a lot of their executives leaving. Would you read into that, Rick?
Yeah, I won't put too much opinion on this. I saw a post from Allie and she said, I've learned my lesson not to, you know, insert my opinion in the first couple of weeks of the news dropping because something always unfolds. There's always some more information that we didn't know before, but yeah, their CTO is officially leaving. And you know, she's been with the company for a long time. This is kind of like the last big leadership exit. Everybody keeps calling it the Sam show, you know, because he's still around and they are actively trying to make a full pivot into being a for-profit organization and issuing him a ton of equity. So, you know, a lot of people are, and this is just what I've read. I have not looked into what's facts-based and not, but a lot of people are really pushing down on a lot of things that he's said before, which is I'm not in this for the money. I want to make sure that people have access to, you know, general artificial intelligence and blah, blah, blah. We want to bring that to the world. But of course, I think it was like, I think what I read was like 10 or 11 billion in equity allocated to Sam Altman with this for-profit transition. I actually don't even know how they're going to facilitate it. Obviously, lots of activity on X, specifically Elon calling it out as well, because remember, he tried to take them to court over this entire debacle. And so it's now gotten even more intense. It's not a, you know, fuzziness between a nonprofit owning a for-profit, but now they're going for it. And with her leaving their CTO, I don't know really what that signals, you know, is it, it said resignation. So she's leaving on her own accord, according to the articles that I've read. Wild times over there.
Has there ever been a game-changing hypergrowth startup like OpenAI or Tesla or any of those that didn't have drama associated to it?
I know.
It seems like every one of these.
This one seems particularly wild. Every 5 seconds, there's some insanity happening. And I don't, you know, whatever, I guess.
Yeah, I like Nick Cage's quote, where they're like, Nicolas Cage, you do all these movies each year, you know, is it for the money? Or you said it's not. I'm thinking about your point of Sam Altman and saying, you know, I'm not doing it for the money. Nick Cage said it well. I have a respect for money, right? So it's he can talk all day about, I'm not in it for the money. But there's always an aspect of compensation for these CEOs, for sure.
I heard them saying that on some podcast, too, that he drives one of the most expensive cars you can find out there. And that he's made his money before OpenAI as well, of course. But, like, you know, to say he's not in it for the money and then have one of the most expensive cars out there and driving it around, like, come on.
I'm curious about the profitability aspect for OpenAI, because talking to the leaders of growth over there, it's still very much a grow at all costs. Like, do what we can, grow, really adjust what we can do to really get users continuing to come back with the latest 4.0, with a lot of the new models that they're rolling out too. So interested to see how that may adjust pricing and kind of the subscription model that they have set up for a lot of existing customers.
I wonder how their enterprise offering is doing, because, you know, I know that the API revenue is probably pretty good, but I wonder how their like ChatGPT enterprise version is doing. Because obviously still, I know we pay for the Teams version. I also pay for several other products. So it's not one or the other, but yeah, I just wonder how that is moving along.
Yeah, I'll say, like, as of today, I'm more Team Anthropic than Team OpenAI these days. Like, now that I've started using Claude, like Claude versus 4.0, I'm like,
Me too.
I'm like, I really, because like Anthropic, again, this is just how they message. We'll see how like things actually play out, because they could go through a similar path, right? But they have been more of that like safety up front kind of mindset, which OpenAI hasn't had as much of that. And I feel like now that I see how Claude does and some of the interfaces, some of the design stuff they're bringing into Claude, like, definitely bigger fan of.
I agree. It's so much more versatile, in my opinion. Plus the 01 preview and ChatGPT doesn't have the ability to upload files. Angie on our team, on our sales team, and I were playing around with some stuff yesterday or the day before, and I was trying to upload some files to do some formatting in ChatGPT, and it wouldn't let me. So their like new preview must restrict that for now, just because it's expensive, I believe. But
yeah, it's like design always matters, because like Claude, when you copy and paste content in, it manages it more like a file than putting it directly into the chatbot message. Like they're just kind of thinking about it more from like an information worker's perspective rather than like everybody and their cousin like going into ChatGPT. Yep. It's like Google versus more of like a Microsoft concept almost. So I think that's why Claude is so much more useful for me, because it treats things as like documents and thinks more like how I would actually use something like this. So
I love getting the AI to fix itself too. Like I was using Claude to build, just to see how it did on building and software. I'm kind of fascinated with AI getting to the point where it can kind of like manage the entirety of a life cycle for software. Mm-hmm. And I started playing around with it just at a very high level to say like, okay, you know, I had heard from someone that they got a demo. One of the CDOs we had dinner with said he got a demo from, I think someone at McKinsey maybe, but it was like the end-to-end software lifecycle where you have it write the user stories. So it creates personas of the users. It writes the user stories. It creates requirements from those user stories. Then it writes, it starts creating mock-ups of interfaces based on those user stories. And then you can turn that obviously into code or iterate on that. So I was having it fix its own code when there were errors in the interface mock-ups that it was giving me. And then you can have it write test cases based on the user stories.
Wow.
And start to have it test its own code, right? This is that like fully, I mean, Devin, the like end-to-end kind of agentic software developer situation, but this is the all-encompassing, like the product manager plus the designer plus the software engineer plus the front end plus the back end plus the QA. Like, how do you get kind of the full concert of building software? And it did fairly good. Like, I mean, I know what each of those steps includes, and so I know what to look for. So there was a lot of guidance involved, but like, I mean, at a first pass, it actually did fairly well. And this was all in Claude, so. Yeah, I don't know. I like it more.
Software building software, the new frontier.
Yeah, I saw that's like software was eating the world. Now it's eating itself.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, if companies are looking for a good clear cut like silver bullet use case, I'm not saying it's gonna work for every company 100% of the time, but code generation seems to be like the number one, especially because engineers will adopt it, right? Like a lot of engineers are already coding with some form of augmentation today from AI, so like, you might as well use like the GitHub copilots or even just giving them access to something like Claude. Cause I was using Claude for just some quick prototyping, some ML stuff. And it was funny cause I kept having the same problem that I had in troubleshooting around like schema name mismatch, which happens all the time. Cause like you're uploading files, you have to like map the column names and stuff like that. And it put in functionality to address that as like a long-term fix rather than just like kept reworking itself. And I was like, wow, this is really impressive. Cause that's like what an actual engineer would do. They would sit down and create functionality that like makes the user define certain things if they like kept failing. So it was really interesting to see like, not only can it code well, but it can also like kind of come up another level to think about like, oh, we keep having this type of problem. Let me create a broader solution for that problem. So it's pretty interesting.
The next level for me is it getting smart enough to prompt the user again in a more collaborative way, because today it's like user driven. So you prompt it goes, it gives you answers, you review, you adjust. But imagine if its confidence was like sub 95% and it queried you for more context, or it included you for more guidance, or if it was directing towards you for the collaborative piece, because that's what we do as humans, right? We're like, hey, I'm kind of stuck on this. What do you think on that? Like, but we know when to stop, unless you're cocky about what you're doing and you think you're right. But like, I just feel like that interface would be really, really interesting, you know?
Yeah, I read a tip on LinkedIn and I've been doing this and it's been working great, but especially for like bigger prompts. So not like the quick little ones, but like the stuff where you're really trying to have it like create an entire document or do something bigger. I've been having, like, just adding at the end, like, ask me any questions that you're not sure on, or like, ask me questions to clarify. And it is actually pretty good at, like, this part of your thing doesn't make sense. So it kind of helps you refine, like, what the prompt is too. But yeah, I definitely think, like, if it gets, if that's more default behavior rather than, like, you have to put it in your prompt, I feel like that would really help.
That's what drives progress, of making time for it. The fact that it has to wait around for the human to go and prompt it to make progress is what's slowing it down, right? So if it's pushing the human to make time and answer questions to keep pace with what they need to do, I mean, that's got to be a multiplier of speed to delivery, right?
Like, right. That's why the it's not a natural, that's why they call it prompt engineering. It's not a natural flow between you and it. There's not a symbiotic, like, collaboration happening yet.
Yeah.
Some people are good at adjusting around that. That's what makes them really good users of AI, is you kind of teach them how to adjust around that. But I just think there's a lot of progress to be made there. You know,
prior teams we worked with have called it Google Foo, before ChatGPT and that interface of, like, what's the best way to Google and get the information you need? And now they've made so many strides just in the past year or two around serving you info that gives you ideas and prompts you to do more actions and stay in their app.
They've gone leaps and bounds beyond. I mean, I took that screenshot, I think last year when we did that presentation, that was just the prompt bar.
Yeah.
Now it's a lot more, the interface is a lot more engaging than just a prompt bar.
Just one more point on the enterprise side of things, because we work with a lot of enterprises, right? We hear all the time about Microsoft and Copilot as their de facto tool for enabling the business. But we don't hear a lot about, hey, we have enterprise ChatGPT. Enterprise Claude.
No.
I'm curious to see how they will continue to expand into the more traditional enterprises, or if they're really going to bump against Microsoft already being in there.
Yeah, because, you know, we all know this, and this is no dig to Microsoft, but they're not known for their user experience, you know? Like, they're known for the interconnectivity between the entire stack.
That's a big
thing. That's the big benefit.
Yep.
And I mean, it's such a struggle working with, like, a Claude and Anthropic, and then going back to, like, Microsoft Copilot, and you're like, dang it.
This is a funny story, because I have, like, a multiple year long feud with, like, Microsoft's authentication in particular, like, just like the login. And I downloaded a video game the other day, and it pulled up, it was like an Xbox game, so it pulled up the Microsoft login, and I literally just, like, closed the game, and I'm not gonna play it.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as I saw that, I was like, nope, I'm not dealing with this at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
What a reputation Microsoft has for UX, you know?
I do have a triggered reaction whenever I see that Microsoft login window, though. Oh, I get it. I get it. I get it. Cool. So for the second half of this episode, now we're going to flip into what we're referring to as listener questions. So, like, we have questions submitted to us. And if you guys, as you're listening to this episode, have additional questions for us too, feel free to email us at info@getalignai.com or drop a comment right here on the YouTube video, or wherever you're listening. Drop them to us, because this is our first time trying this. If it's valuable for our audience, let us know, and we can do another episode like this in the future. All to say, we have some really interesting questions, some horror stories in here too, that customers have, you know, asked us about historically, that we want to compile and really do more of a Q&A as a format for the second half of this episode. So I had Reagan and Brennan go through and kind of upvote the ones that they like the most. We're going to go through as many as we can in the time that we have too. So Reagan, Brandon, if you're ready, I'm going to start with the first question.
Let's do it.
Dear AI or die, we are in the early stages of adopting AI, and one of the biggest concerns we're hearing from our legal and IT teams is about data privacy and security. They're worried that introducing AI might expose us to risks we haven't fully accounted for, especially when it comes to handling sensitive customer data. What are the best practices that we need to follow to ensure our AI implementations are secure? And how do we balance the benefits of AI with the need to protect our data and privacy? So, very loaded question here, but really with the concerns from IT teams, especially around AI exposing risks, and how do they balance the benefits of AI and the need to protect data and privacy?
Yeah, I think my stance is becoming more and more pronounced. It might actually be a little bit different than Reagan's on some of these, because I'm starting to think about it. Yeah, we might have, like, a diverging view on risk. Because my stance now, and maybe you agree with me on this too, actually, is, like, you pick a large framework to work towards, and then you prioritize, so, like, something like NIST or ISO or adherence to one of the bigger compliance frameworks. And then you iteratively kind of, like, pick the highest priority ones and address those and then move forward through it. Because I think where a lot of teams are getting bogged down is they're imagining like all potential scenarios, and they are getting too stuck because that's almost like a safe zone of like, oh, let's figure out the compliance risk control stuff before we start building, before we start buying, right? So I'd call this like the minimal governance you can put in place and then just iteratively build that up, right? And the alternative strategy is more of like the full comprehensive, like let's put everything in place up front and then let's start building, let's start buying. I think it's much more important to do the minimal amount to getting the AI solutions built or bought and leveraged inside of the organization instead of worrying about like every potential issue, assuming you're not in a heavily regulated industry is my caveat at the end of that statement. But especially for folks that are like in manufacturing or other areas, like obviously they need to be risk, have a risk mindset of like, how do we mitigate the risk? But we can't let that distract us too much from getting in and like adding value with AI. Cause I think teams are getting bogged down right now.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you. I think of it very much like, you know, your house. All right. So we do a lot of things to secure our house to make sure people don't break in and steal our stuff. Right. And there's kind of the basics. You got a lock on your door, you got locks on your windows. And you know, people have different hygiene around locking their doors and their windows and whatever. There are some houses that have Ring cameras, yep, or even the things you can put on your door that when it opens, it sounds an alarm that you can set, like a trip alarm. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of things you can do to secure your house, right? So, and I'd say that the problem today is that maybe there wasn't a lot of emphasis on securing the house, and now there are troves of people coming to your house, which is like AI. So like people are saying, okay, do we have the basics though? Do we have the basics? Do we have good locks on the doors? Do we have good locks on the windows? Because now, like, if you buy a house out in the country where you know not a lot of people are coming by versus you have a house in the middle of the city, like you're going to treat kind of, you know, the security of your home maybe a little bit differently.
That's that industry parallel.
Right. Yeah. Or if you've got millions of dollars of jewelry in your house, which is like the regulatory, maybe like things you're protecting versus, you know, if they broke in, there's really not much to steal. Or I think the way that's kind of how I think about it sometimes. I know that's a drastic oversimplification, but when I think about AI, like, there are net new risks. There are maybe new types of ways people are trying to get into your house, or like maybe it's somebody trying to hack onto your network and your internet, or, you know, things that maybe you didn't think about, but there's also the basics. And so when we were working with enterprises, I think the biggest thing is some people are realizing that the locks on their doors aren't that great. Mm. And like, yeah, you should probably spend some time and just get the basics down. Like, this is the kind of basic data governance, basic policies, basic things that are now getting exposed because AI is being leveraged, or they want to leverage it. And the folks that had some basic security in place, like, they're not really starting from that point. They're just looking at, okay, now we've got to maybe secure our network, yeah, and, you know, not within their company, I'm talking about in the context of the house example, which maybe not a lot of people do, you know, but like now we're going to do that. And so I think to your point, Brendan, it's like the framework's important. You're not going to be able to secure everything. There's a risk tolerance element to this. Every single use case is going to be different in terms of how you assess risk. There are going to be some use cases that are going to be totally low risk and some that'll be super high risk just because of the data that it's touching, right? And you know, you got to think about IP and you got, so the idea of risk and the idea of security is really robust and comprehensive. And I think where people get trapped is they think they need to have ironclad bars on all their windows because AI is happening. And so they go overkill, you know, and the basics are important. The frameworks that you mentioned, NIST and ISO, they cover a lot of those basics. Mm-hmm. Put those in place, you know, and if you don't, I can see why you're scared a little bit about AI, sure, you know, like I can see that because it is a little different, right? We are now talking about the remote work thing freaked a lot of people out in cyber because they weren't used to having that many remote workers not on their network. And now we're adding AI into the mix as well. And there's just bad hygiene all around. And so you get your overwhelmed cyber teams who are trying to get the basics down, and then you tell them they also now need to support AI. They're probably pretty annoyed and frustrated. So have a little bit of sympathy, empathy for your, you know, cyber teams, but also don't try to do it all at once, because you will never, ever, ever get to where you want to be.
Your point on use case by use case is especially relevant, because that's where a lot of teams are starting, is they're just saying, let's just focus on internal facing use cases where AI is impacting our associates. That's perceived as less of a risk than anything that's direct customer facing or influencing product buying decisions in that way. That's a step that a lot of companies are taking today. It's just, we have a million ideas for AI. Let's just start with ensuring our framework, our foundation for security that we've set up, can fit into at least use cases that are internal employee facing. That's inherently a lower risk than customer facing.
Yeah, and I think like anchoring on use cases too, I think really changes the conversation as well, because it goes from like this endless what if, because there are so many things that come up with AI that can potentially. So yeah. I think that's where if you take the incremental, like, okay, based on what we want to use it for the first 1 to 3 to 5, like, okay, what does that open up for us as far as risk? And then how do we manage that, right? And then, okay, what are the next 5 to 10? Because that, you can also start choosing your use cases based on your risk profile, like you mentioned, like picking the internal stuff, picking the stuff that doesn't touch sensitive data. Like, I think that can really help change the conversation from more speculative to very like tactical, like, okay, what do we need to start structuring and managing first, and then kind of work forward and build up from there.
Yeah, and the best COEs we've worked with on risk, they do that exactly, especially with vendors. Like, we are a vendor that has AI in our product, so we often go through this process as well. So not only do we advise companies on how to think about this, but we also go through companies' processes to make sure that they're allowed to use our AI. And part of that process that we've seen, the good ones, they contextualize all of it. Risk reward. Like, what are you touching? What are you doing? What model, where does it sit? Like, all your basic vendor questions, right? You got that piece, and then you got your internal development considerations as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay, great. Next question. This is a good one. I like this one. In our company, we have a lot of ideas for AI use cases, so relevant to what we just talked about, but they tend to come from the business side rather than the technical teams. Oh, this is interesting. So sometimes it feels like they're asking for things from the business that aren't realistic or feasible given our current capabilities. How do we balance the ambition of business-driven AI use cases with the practical limitations of our internal AI team and infrastructure? So this kind of comes back to the build versus buy topic that we brought up before, where this person who wrote in really has a lot of ideas from the business that may not be, I refer to as like tethered to actual real capabilities that they have internally today. So to their question, how do they find that balance of ambition from the business versus practical limitations of their internal AI team and their infrastructure today?
Like, you do a lot of this with our customers. Do you want to talk? You want to kick us off?
I lean back into the classics, and Brennan's going to love this, the product management aspect, right? Of like, when we're talking about potential use cases in our space, one, I think a lot of these ideas, when I talk about them being untethered, it's not only untethered to the technical feasibility and the capabilities internally, but also the business strategy, right? If we have all of these ideas for how AI could supplement our work, we need to step back and say, department by department, how do these ideas we have align to the strategic priorities of our department, let alone the wider organization there? And that's where I see a lot of teams, even just starting there, of like looking at how do we make sure our business users are bringing up ideas and our leaders are understanding the ideas coming in and really helping to prioritize for their department. Hey, I want to put my hand up as the department leader, as these are my top three that are not only AI, but also strategically relevant to projects that we're working on, KPIs that we've set for ourselves in our department this quarter, this year, right? So like, I think starting there, I think is a good approach. Brennan, I want to see if you have any additional thoughts on that for the business and helping them.
Yeah, definitely. I think like, it's great when you have people who are passionate about ideas. They tend to be a little bit solution focused, of course, but it's great too, because then you know that they're engaged and they'll probably work through a project with you, right? Because AI projects require a lot of time on the business's part to give feedback and guidance and even to adopt the thing at the end of the development process, not even just throughout the process. So I think that's always a great signal, like, hey, I've got someone who's engaged on the business side that wants to leverage AI. They want to be an early adopter of these technologies, which is always great from a technical perspective. I think the hard part becomes then kind of like the back and forth of like, okay, well, what's really feasible? It's usually what data is out there, right? And just to give a very tangible example, I was on a call this week. It was like, we want a recommendation system for sales. That seems like a good idea, right? And then we got into like, well, how could we even create recommendations? Like, where does that data come from? What do we really need to recommend you? Is it like the thing that's out of stock, how to buy something equivalent, or here's a competitor's thing that you're looking for, here's our version of that thing? Like, so it becomes a really interesting conversation because there's that back and forth of like, okay, what are you trying to accomplish? And then what is feasible? And I think that's where, again, it's great to have the engaged stakeholders because they will usually be like, oh, well, we can't do that big crazy thing. But, oh, we could start off by extracting spec sheets into a database to have something searchable, right, as like a first place to start with that we can then build into more of a recommendation system, right? So I think if you have that engagement, you can start digging into their problems. You can uncover kind of parallel solutions that are more feasible based on what data is out there.
You got to drill into context. We, Brendan and I did a live LinkedIn webinar yesterday. If you're listening to this and you want to check that out, we talked a lot about this during the webinar too. But I mean, I'm on another project that is like hot potato on who owns this. I was like, I need a sign off person. I need somebody who's going to own this, use this. Like, I need users. I need an owner. I need, because when it comes down from on high, you know, like this is a priority, but they didn't give it to somebody to own. You run into those problems where it's not going to be aligned. It's not going to be well received or adopted or integrated because that person doesn't care enough about it, or there is no owner, or there is no person who gives, I keep calling it the arbiter of truth, right? That person who knows the system so well they can call things out when it's wrong, or if it's wrong, or can help you design on preventing it from being wrong. And who makes that decision? Like, imagine going into a company and you're like, who here knows the right way to do supply chain at this company? Or who here knows the right way to optimize it, right? Like, nobody's going to like raise their hand and be like, I know I'm the right, I know how to do that. And so you run into these problems with the AI because these AI systems are supposed to do that. They're supposed to optimize towards the right way of doing a thing. And if you're good and you're thoughtful as a company, you will very, you know, thoughtfully generate KPIs. Those KPIs will be associated with the right way, the thing you're optimizing to, and you can better design the systems to meet those objectives. But
that's so funny you say that. That's one of the hardest things I find in our projects we do is identifying the person who's going to say, yes, I sign off on this. Same point where it's like, as we set a lot of best practices or identify best practices in the orgs for managing this stuff, nobody raises their hand and says like, I have the best practice. Nobody wants to stick their neck out and say that.
It's so true. It's so true. And like, it's so funny because there's no, I think it was Salima that was saying this. She's on one of our previous episodes. I don't remember which one. It was early on though. But she said like, there's one neck to choke. Right? Like if you're the person, it either goes really well for you or you're the neck to choke. Like it does.
That's why I was like, if you got a business stakeholder, it's like, I'm really passionate about this thing. Like they might be signing up to be the chokeable neck, I guess is a rough way to say it. But, you know, that's why it's like, it's a great thing. Even if their solutions are infeasible, it's like, okay, like let's try to find something else that we can help them with. Cause like they're at least willing to like take the charge. So like, let's help them, you know, get out there.
But this goes to show you like how human centric these systems still are. Like you can build, like there are some things where you build it and people are like, oh, that I would have never thought of that. And that's perfect. And there are some things that haven't linked up, but that is not common. I just want people to know that is not common. Like you have to be thoughtful about designing these things.
And just back to the point on like technical feasibility, the person asking this question was really focused on our internal capabilities and our internal infrastructure. But I think the role, especially of data scientists in an org, as they're creating more of these AI centers of excellence and these AI councils, is not only staying up on what capabilities can you build internally, but what capabilities are solutions coming to market with. I think the role is evolving in terms of being that point person. So these business folks can come to you and talk about not only internal capabilities based on a use case, but also external capabilities that we could potentially bring in as solutions. Like a lot of times there's not that point person that they can go to as like that trusted partner inside of their organization to recommend solutions for use cases that they have today. And I think that may change.
Yeah, what a shift to lean on these AI systems to tell you the best practices. I know I keep warning of this and everyone's like, oh, these things are going to be the teachers. They're going to be the ones that are giving you what's best. And today I have not run into any, you know what I mean? There are little surprises of like, oh yeah, I guess that is better.
Yeah.
But holistically I've not run into any, like the people still know what's best. They still have, as I think I was listening to Chamath on Palihapitiya on a podcast yesterday. And he said, humans will always have judgment and taste.
Always. Yeah.
And like, even if these things can reason and have intelligence, humans will still have the judgment and taste. And I just thought that was so interesting. Like, you know, that's where the line will be drawn, maybe.
I wonder if AI will pick that up though, right? Because we learn judgment and taste, not to go on a whole philosophical
cycle. It is.
We should just have an episode of that. Like, we should just sit down and like take the problems and unpack them, because I think that'd be really interesting. But yeah, I wonder if we'll learn that over time. You know?
I think it was Mark Andreessen that put this on X recently, but he was like, do some humans even know how to reason? Like, we keep like beating these systems up on the AI side. Like, the AI doesn't know how to reason. It's just learning from patterns. And it's like, well, most humans also don't know how to reason. Yeah. And like, they're just learning from patterns and regurgitating things they've heard before, which I did just several times in the last 5 minutes. So like, what's the difference?
Yeah, it's like they called it a neural network for a reason. Like they use the neuron as like the way to learn how to do it. So like I see a lot of people saying like, well, it doesn't think like us, like especially with the new release, it's like it doesn't think like we do. And I'm like, well, how do we think? I think it's an interesting question that artificial intelligence kind of pokes us on. It's like, well,
it's so
is
interesting.
It really so different, you know?
But, yeah, Reid Hoffman said artificial intelligence is a bad term, because you're basically saying it's learning human intelligence. It's just maybe the mechanism in which it's retrieving it back to is artificial, but it's not creating artificial intelligence on its own. It's just kind of learning from the human things that we've already been doing and like regurgitating that. So I guess his point is novelty.
Yeah.
Right.
Is there any original human thought anymore? Right.
Right.
It's more of a mirror
back
to us in that
way. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think good segue into the next question. I love this one. Okay. And this one's a little bit more philosophical. So let's see how deep we go on this. I think this is a good question to end on. So as AI becomes more advanced, do you think we'll see a future where companies are fully AI run with minimal human involvement? What would that look like? And what would the role of employees be in such an enterprise?
This is
I can take a crack.
Question.
Yeah.
So I remember two things. One, I saw a LinkedIn post that was talking about they pulled a bunch of tech folks. I can't remember the exact details, so I'll keep it vague, but it was like a lot of rich people think that this might be the first year where there's a $1 billion company that is just one person. It's like one person and AI, and that is like the first time that will happen, which I think is really interesting.
You could cheat on that one though, because you could just have all contractors.
That's true. No FTEs. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think we're not like, we're getting closer and closer to this being like a real thing, right? Especially in software development. I think software development's got the biggest, like, now that we kind of see how things are playing out, like software development's going to be the biggest impacted area, especially with the code generation and just like the rapid increase. Like I saw GitHub Copilot said it's like 55% faster, right? So theoretically, one can do the work of two, right? Which is insane, because that's like one of the highest paid people roles inside of a tech organization. So I think it's going to be extremely interesting to see what the ramifications are there. I also remember this kind of conversation around like, what if AI took over parts of the government, right? Like what if it did a lot of the administrative tasks? That was part of like the super intelligence argument of like, one of the big risks is as we give more and more decision making power to it, we become more and more beholden to the outcomes, which becomes a very interesting governance control problem, of course. So I think this becomes interesting to think through, and I think important to think through, because what does the role of humans become around these AI things? Because of course, right now, as we mentioned, it's mostly augmentation of your decision-making, augmentation of your work. And I think that will still be the case for a while. But I also think about like, you know, 10 years out, I think that starts shifting, especially as people trust it more to make decisions and it's learned more about our specific way of working, that it can kind of emulate that. I think it becomes very important to think about what is that role of oversight that people play, because that seems like what we become more and more focused on is like making sure it's doing the right thing, We still have to develop the strategy. We still have to manage the relationships between people, but AI can handle a lot of that more mundane inner workings. And I think companies will become smaller, frankly. Like, they'll need less people to run the way they do today.
We're already seeing this. You look at startups, the revenue per person that it's expected used to be 250K in revenue per head.
Mm.
That used to be like kind of the golden standard for venture-backed startups, right, is what I'm talking about. And then now it's like 400, 450,
mm-hmm.
even 500
mm-hmm.
is kind of becoming the golden standard, because if you are not using AI to be efficient as a startup, you are going to fall behind. So, and think about the margins. That's the point of this, is to lower the costs per the revenue you can generate, which is the margin expectation.
Yeah.
Which in SaaS obviously is very large. And so we're saying now it's going to be larger, right? And I just think that's kind of fascinating. We've seen a lot of that. I mean, we purposefully keep our team pretty nimble and tight, especially as we continue to grow. And we're seeing a lot of other companies do that as well. Mm-hmm. It used to be a signal to the market that as a company, the more you're growing headcount, the more... Yeah,
yep.
The better you're doing.
Yep.
And it's so funny because now it's almost the opposite. Like, if you can grow while not growing headcount, you're doing something right. All right. That's why they keep talking about this one person billion-dollar unicorn idea. And I just find that to be fascinating. And then you start to see how some of the stuff in the venture-backed startup world starts to permeate, you know, as those companies grow, they become the big, large billion-dollar companies, and then they kind of set the precedent as a tech native or AI native company for other technology companies or other non-tech native companies. And it starts to like trickle down. And what's the difference between, you know, a small, nimble venture-backed technology company versus this big kind of 100-year-old monolithic enterprise?
Yeah.
You know, what, there are lots of differences, complexity being number one, and then legacy probably being number two. And then if you think about how does AI change those two things,
mm-hmm.
well, AI is literally built for complexity.
Yeah.
Or else we would be using software rules-based stuff.
Yeah.
And number two, the legacy, like we've seen Amazon put out that huge announcement about them using AI to fix a bunch of legacy stuff in their software.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that with, you know, the Klarna announcement. Not saying that Salesforce is legacy. I'm just saying that they have it and they rebuilt it using AI, and now they're getting rid of their relationship with Salesforce and Workday. Workday maybe being a little more legacy than Salesforce, but like, I wonder how big the disruption is truly going to be. And I think it's going to start, and I've said this several times, but it's going to start by companies growing EBITDA, growing revenue, and not hiring along with the growth. It'll start there. It won't start with like the massive layoffs. It's going to start with driving margin and efficiency and just kind of becoming stagnant in terms of layoffs might be to like swap out skill sets actually, but not necessarily to reduce total headcount. So like that, I don't know if we'll ever truly get to like fully AI run. Maybe. I don't know.
It'll start with the really small companies, right? The brand new companies trying it as a model. And when investors look at a company's future success, they always look at the leadership team. And maybe it'll go less from the wide leadership team of people who are on there to the single leader and how good their algorithm is, or like how often they're updating that to support it. I just wonder too, long term, what does that mean for company culture? Does it even exist anymore? Is the culture all about just like customer service and customer centricity at the end of the day?
Yeah.
Is there even like this internal...
The high touch, high EQ. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that'll be so interesting.
It's so such a fascinating thought experiment. I don't, you know, for anybody that says they know exactly where this is going, they're lying. Because there's no way to know. Because we're all just kind of sitting on our hands waiting for the next breakthrough, right?
Yeah, it's always interesting with AI too, because it's so hard to not, like, it's so hard to overhype it, or it's so easy to overhype it, because you can imagine a world in which that thing is true.
Yeah.
And the question becomes, like, when? Like, 100 years? Because, like, it's hard to say, like, any of these things that, like, feel really far away are actually pretty close now, especially, I think, code generation in particular. We can see, like, how rapidly that can change the workflow for a developer. and for like a product team. And then we're like, okay, well, if you take that, that's kind of ground zero for like a lot of tech stuff. Okay, let's look at all the other tech stuff. And then let's look at the non-tech stuff and see how quickly that can change too. So if you take that out 5-10 years, let alone 50, you go, oh, well, maybe it's more of a when, not a if for a lot of this far looking stuff, you know?
Yeah. And who can really anticipate that timing? I think you'd be the richest person in the world if you could. But like, I think the people who are the value deniers of AI fully are asleep or delusional. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just no way. There's literally no way. We just observed too many examples for that to be the case. I mean, I saw this whole rampage on LinkedIn about this person saying how overhyped AI was. And I get it. I get it. And not just overhyped, but just hyped in general. Like, this is just, it's going to be like crypto. It's going to be like, you know, everybody keeps saying that. And I just so fundamentally disagree with that. Mm-hmm. And it's not because, you know, we're in the space and we're building a company in that space. That's nice. Like, of course. But I also just generally believe it. You know, the shoe will drop if that's not the case. So why would I want to be in a space building a company in a place where the shoe's going to drop, you know?
Yeah, and I remember reading one, like an anti-AI kind of thing, like it's overhyped, it's a magic trick was the phrase they kept using, like an expensive magic trick, because I talk about how much it costs to train the models and stuff, and you read that, and then you actually, like, I use it daily all the time, so I'm like, it's so hard to, like, hear that and then see it, like, in my own use, and then I hear in customers of, like, they can't, like, I don't want to, they can't take it away from people, you know, like, once I give it to them, they can't, like, pull back. Access to things like Copilot, because like people rely on it so much. So I know it's hard to quantify like the value sometimes, but it's just like to inherently gut check yourself and say like, is this truly helping? It's really hard to say no, you know, like I'm not saying it might be over, there might be too much money in it. It might be like over invested or whatever, like can't speak to the financial side of it, but just the pure value side of it. It's really hard to deny that right now. You know,
you can live without crypto, right? It's
right.
It's getting harder and harder to live without AI.
Yeah. I mean, once you get it, you can't unget it.
Yeah.
You know, I've watched the light bulb moment for so many people and they're like, whoa, okay, got it. I get it now. Like the, you know, this boot camp we're doing, it's like the light bulb moment was, oh my God, it can fix its own problem. That's so cool. Mm-hmm. Like, God, that, I mean, if you've been a programmer and you've tried to decode your own code, like, and it goes and does it in a blink of an eye and then it works and you see it work, you're like, that is,
it's magic. Yeah.
It's magic, but it's logical. It like, it makes sense, you know? So I agree. There's a lot of overhype on things it can't do. And I think that does taint the view for a lot of people, but the stuff it can do, I mean, let's not lose track of that or lose sight of that. Cause it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, like it can't count the R's in strawberry every time, but it can build an entire code base from scratch for what you want. So like, I think it's just like, it's like what you, and like a 5-year-old could count the R's in like strawberry, and there's probably not a lot of people in the world that can code at the level that it does, you know?
Well, I think that's actually an excellent point. I know we're about to wrap, but I think that's such an excellent point, and I just want to highlight that. People will look for the simple things it can't do.
Oh, yeah.
And then it extrapolates. We're thinking about them in terms of humans. Mm-hmm. So if it, like if you were to go to a human and say, count the number of R's in the word strawberry and they couldn't do it, you'd be like, you're dumb. You know, you don't know how to spell. You're illiterate, whatever. But like, you can't do that with AI. It's like, it's totally two different skill sets. Like, It might be really bad at that, but it can do this extraordinarily sophisticated thing on the other side of it, you know.
And the advice we give each other as humans is focus on your strengths. So yeah, it's interesting.
So it's been kicking our ass at chess for like.
Very true. Minesweeper. Yeah. Well, this was fun, guys. Thank you, listeners, for submitting questions. Please drop us some additional ones. If you'd like us to do another episode like this, let us know. This was episode 18 of AI or Die. Thanks again for listening in, everybody. We'll see you in a month about the next episode. We'll see you in about a month. For the next episode.
Halloween episode is going
to
be fun.
Oh, yes. Yes. We'll think about what to do special for Halloween. All right. Thanks, everybody.